1965, Cincinnati Bar Association versus Edward Kathman. Mr. Crichton.
Chief Justice Moyer and the court, Richard Crichton on behalf of the Cincinnati Bar Association is here. Mr. Robert Gary, Cincinnati Bar is also here with me. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for the following. May it please the court, the Bar Association objects to the findings and conclusions of the Board of Commissioners on one critical issue. That is, whether the respondent, Mr. Kathman, violated disciplinary rule 3101A by aiding a non-lawyer in the unauthorized practice of law. We are here because we think that it is important for this court to draw a line in the sand, say what conduct is appropriate and what is inappropriate in this area that keeps coming back again and again to this court for consideration. That is the marketing and sale of legal documents to members of the Ohio public. We've been down this road before. We have an out-of-state organization. The estate plan comes up with what it feels is a good set of documents for a living trust. They solicit participation by Ohio citizens who are lay people to sell these legal documents in the state of Ohio. They buy mailing lists. They send out mailings. They generate leads. The leads are then given to this group of insurance and financial insurance agents and financial counselors who are laymen. They go out to the homes of Ohio citizens and they sell a living trust to a layperson.
That's a great concept, isn't
it? It's a great concept, and it works, and it's targeted at exactly those citizens that you would think that would be targeted doing that is the elderly. They buy their mailing list and they target people who are eligible for our organization. It's a very slick and very good, well thought out marketing scheme. What's the problem here? This court has since 1997, in the Miller case, Taylor, and Hardesty, clearly stated that attorneys have a very solemn duty to their clients, to counsel, to meet with them, to confer. What's wrong here is that the respondent met with or telephone contacted these people after the horse was out of the barn. The problem is that at the point of sale of a legal document, the consideration of whether it is the appropriate document, whether a trust is warranted in a particular case, the counseling, the sales pitch, the pressure is being applied by a layman. Only after that occurred did the respondent get involved. That's the problem that the court has to deal with. What are we going to do about this? Two violations were found. The one that wasn't found, the Bar Association believes, is the important one. Did the respondent aid in the unauthorized practice of law? We know from the Namath case that this court decided that we do not have to have a formal finding of unauthorized practice to find that an attorney has aided in the unauthorized practice. So the first question that you have to ask is, was there unauthorized practice of law under these circumstances? And I submit that under a long line of cases, going back to certainly 1934, the Dworkin case, 1966, in the Huntington Bank case, up to the present time, this court has consistently said that when you are approaching people with the concept of basically doing a particular type of legal document, a trust in this case, which is the one that seems to be the hot issue these days, that is the delivery of legal services.
A few minutes ago, you said that the real, what is the problem here? And the problem here is that the respondent contacted these folks, you said, after the sale had been made, in effect.
Yes, yes. Sir.
All right. Would have been equally as bad had he contacted them before the sale was made, wouldn't it?
Well, then you'd have a different issue. You'd have to be just soliciting.
Okay. That's why it would be bad. So, my question is, what if respondent didn't contact them at all? Would it still be unauthorized practice by these other folks?
Absolutely.
All right. What about the what if they had just published a book and said, this is how you do it, and the forms are in the back, fill out the forms, and you've got your living trust. Like they do these books, because they always bother me, that send you a will, a packet for a will, a book, how to prepare your own will, and then you prepare your own will with the form that's in there.
What's missing, Justice Stiglitz, is the personal contact and the pressure of an individual meeting. The same difference, if you could use an analogy, that I may send out a solicitation in writing to a victim of an automobile accident and say that I, Rich Creighton, practice this type of law and follow all the guidelines that this court has set forth. I'm allowed to do that. What I'm not allowed to do is go to the home and knock on the door. Mm-hmm. And that's what they do. That's what the state planning group did. That's the problem. What it is a fine line, Justice Douglas, between what is appropriate here, because we're talking about the free market. People want to have these trusts, perhaps, but how are they sold is the question that this court has to deal with. And so I would submit to you that what we have here is a clear unauthorized practice situation by the estate planning group.
Well, maybe a fine line, but you've drawn a pretty clear.
Well, I'm trying to the second question then that we need to reach is, did the respondent aid in that unauthorized practice?
Do we know the opinion of the board doesn't tell us why the board made its decision, why the panel recommended and then the board adopted the decision that DR-3101A is not violated? Does the record, I haven't looked at the record, does it help us in any way to tell us?
I believe it does, but it doesn't help you to determine why they did not find that. I would agree that...
That's what I'm looking for. We don't know.
No, I see nothing in the record.
We don't know if it's because the panel believed that Mr. Fox was not, and the other group was not engaged in the unauthorized practice, or whether it concluded that respondent wasn't helping in that.
We don't know that. We just do not know that. But I would submit on the facts that they did find that you can reach no other conclusion, because if we know that Mr. Fox, on the record, was the person going out and talking to the people and had the initial contact that this was initially set up. There were changes made by respondent as time went on, and we can address those, but initially what he was doing clearly is Mr. Fox was the one going out and having the initial contact, and that the respondent did not get involved until after the sale was made, the check was in hand, and the forms were all filled out. That's when he got the call. And therefore, when you look at it, it has to be that Mr. Fox was engaged in the unauthorized practice of law. Because clearly, as Justice Douglas pointed out, if Mr. Kastman had never been involved in this at all, had never entered the picture, clearly Mr. Fox, what Mr. Fox was doing was unauthorized practice. So then the question, you have to step back one step and say, well, okay, is what the respondent did, is that aiding? Well, I submit to you it is, because here's what's going on in the big world out there, the real picture. These companies aren't stupid. They saw some of the other opinions of this court. They know that they have a problem with solicitation and going in there without an attorney involved. They call Ohio's attorney state. An attorney has to be involved.
To make it short, the respondent's activity enables the non-lawyers to say, we have a lawyer working with us.
Exactly.
Yeah.
He throws holy water on the whole deal after it's done, and they think that makes it okay. It is the position of the Cincinnati Bar Association that's not okay. That the emphasis that this court has put recently on the importance of attorney counseling, we have to put it now in a time frame. When does it occur? It has to occur at the point where the people are making the decision. Your honors know that what happens in real life is, once somebody writes a check for $1,900-some and hands it to someone, they're not going to change their minds unless somebody moves heaven and earth, because they're going to be embarrassed. They're going to be humiliated. They're going to feel loyalty to those men who went out there and sold them this concept. That's the horses out of the barn and running down the lane, and that's the problem here.
You say these cases keep coming up. What you want us to do is be pretty affirmative in what we say with regard to this issue.
Absolutely.
In that regard, could we find a violation of 3101A, and yet, because it has been confusing in the past, still have the same sanction?
You could, absolutely.
I know we can, but wouldn't that be a reasonable thing? I mean, would it be unreasonable?
It would not be unreasonable.
Thank you.
Did Mr. Kaplan ever counsel any of these people that they should not have a
legal trust? I believe there was one instance where it was a close call because of the size of the estate.
If the British Council should not have a legal trust, did they get the $1,900 back?
My understanding was that they would.
And he could get paid for his legal services and counsel them regardless of whether the $1,900 was refunded?
I believe that his personal policy was that if they did not go through with this, that he would refund the entire. This is not.
He would refund, or Fox would refund, or both?
Both.
Did that ever happen?
No. There were about 45 instances of this particular scheme going through. And there was not one instance, was it? I mean, to describe it, in fairness to the respondent, nobody complained about this. No person complained that they were cheated. No one is saying here that the fees charged by the respondent were inappropriate, excessive, or anything even remotely like that. That's why, in response to Justice Douglas, in fairness, whatever this court feels that the appropriate sanction is fine with the Cincinnati Bar Association, the important thing is the principle. And I do recommend, I think the Supreme Court of Missouri has dealt with this issue in the Mid-American Trust case. It is a very comprehensive decision. And then there is that line of cases from Colorado, starting in 91. There were three of them. They cite Florida. There's an Iowa decision on this as well. We cited in our paper. We're not alone here in Ohio facing this issue. There is guidance out there, and we believe that if you look at the Mid-American case, it is a wonderful case. The Supreme Court of Missouri took a lot of time studying this issue, and we believe that if you follow the same reasoning that the Supreme Court of Missouri used, that you would reach the same result, and you would find that this was the agent in the unauthorized practice of law here. And that's what we seek, is that finding in a very clear, right-line test that says this is appropriate conduct for an attorney, and this is not.
Thank you, Mr. Creighton. Mr. Kelly.
Your Honor, just addressing one of the issues right off the top, the issue of Justice Stratton. There has been a refund. All the monies were returned. These people were advised right from the beginning by Mr. Kaplan concerning the payments of the money and where the money goes. I'd like to address a couple issues here, and one of the issues is in terms of Justice Douglas raised the issue of the penalty. In this case, we have Mr. Kaplan here, and Mr. Creighton quite honestly says we want this court to draw a bright line in the sand and let everybody know what the ground rules are for the preparation of these documents. The one problem that we have with that, Your Honors, is that the bright line in the sand is being drawn across Mr. Kaplan's back in this instance. And what we have, when you take a look at the Missouri case, which Mr. Creighton refers to, and you go back and look at a couple cases, and in particular, if you take a look at the Hanna case, and when this court decided the Hanna case, it advised that by doing so, Hanna, a non-lawyer engaged in the practice of law in rendering the services, in a reference that he did not even recommend that the people who he was counseling contact an attorney. And in this instance, all of these people contacted Mr. Kathman. They were all referred to Mr. Kathman. There was no issue about the payment of money and these people being locked into a situation where they were going to be out the money for the payment of the trust. Mr. Kathman made it clear from step one that there was no trust. The record before the board clearly laid that out. One of the issues in this case...
Pardon me, I'm not following. What do you mean there was no trust?
There was no trust until Mr. Kathman reviewed the documents with each prospective client that he had.
I thought that that's the best spin on it, but I thought that in practically speaking, we were told by the findings of the board that there was a phone call, that these people were all set up, and then there was, as your adversary speaks of it, a holy water thrown on it by an effort to make a phone call.
Your Honor, it was more than a phone call. It was a phone call where he reviewed all the documentation and made a determination whether they should or should not have the trust.
Did we have testimony? I'm just curious because these are repetitive kind of things. It seems it's a little bit of a business. I'm just curious, do we have testimony before the panel about any clients who were counseled that this particular living trust would not benefit them?
Yes, Your Honor. There's one specific example in there where Mr. Kathman advised the person that the trust may not be in the individual's best interest because there would not be any benefit to him because of the size of his estate. At that point in time, the individual insisted on going through with it, turned around and bought a $40,000 Cadillac afterwards, and made the whole purpose of the trust useless at that point in time. Mr. Kathman refunded the money to the individual, all the money that could be refunded except for the preparation of the documents. All that was returned to him. But when you take a look at this entire instance and you want to draw this bright line in the sand, during the course of this, Mr. Kathman's attempting to get into compliance and saying, listen, if I've made a mistake, let me know where I've made a mistake. The mistake was with the letterhead. The board report clearly shows that Mr. Kathman said, I felt uneasy about that. I corrected it right away. So then he said, how do I correct this situation? He goes to the Cincinnati Bar Association to correct it. They advise him on how to correct it. He does exactly what they say to do. He still has a problem. But in terms of sprinkling the holy water on this situation, and when you take a look at the cases...
How many clients do we have a number from the testimony? How many trusts?
I want to say there were 40 to 45, Your Honor.
And did we also have testimony about Mr. Kathman's expertise in the area of estate planning?
Yes, there's testimony in there as far as what he did in order to acquaint himself with the trust and make sure that he was knowledgeable about the language that was contained in there and that he satisfied himself that each document that was being used was legally sufficient.
I thought he had never written a trust before his association with this group. Is that right?
He did not write a trust prior to the preparation of the trust in this instance, but what he had done prior to writing any trust or engaging in this occupation, Your Honor, he had satisfied himself that the trust document, he read the trust document over, became acquainted with the workbooklet, and satisfied himself that those documents were good documents.
But I guess the Chief and I are both wondering, I mean, one who knows very little about tax planning could say, I read the documents, but that doesn't answer the question about the knowledge about the need for the trust, when they're appropriate, how the assets should be divided between the spouses, that sort of thing.
I agree with you, Your Honor. And it would have been so easy for the Cincinnati Bar Association to bring somebody up
and
to testify and say, this document and Mr. Kathman's conduct, both the document and his conduct in this matter were unacceptable, and there's no record before that board. So when the question becomes, why didn't the board find this They didn't find it because there was not clear and convincing evidence, and there was no evidence that Mr. Kathman's conduct in this matter or his preparation of these documents fell below the standard of any attorney concerning the preparation of these documents.
You still haven't answered the question. What is his, what's his training, what's his knowledge
Nothing.
In the area of tax matters, the state tax?
As far as the state tax matters concerned, Jaron, he's looked over the documents, he's standing.
No, what's his experience? That's what we're asking. What makes him qualified?
He's prepared wills.
Other than he's admitted to practice law in the state.
He's admitted to practice law, that's for sure. But he's prepared wills, and he has done trust. He's done real estate work, and he's familiar with tax law. Is that the primary focus of his practice? It's not the primary
what
focus.
What is the primary focus?
The primary focus of his practice, he does criminal work, and he does domestic relation work, and he probates some wills in the state, Your Honor.
Did he know any of these people that were involved in...
He knew Fox from when he was younger. They had gone to school together, and then he had reviewed all the information that Fox brought to him in order to satisfy himself. He knew that Fox was a certified financial planner, level 6.
Did he know any of the clients?
Did he know the clients? No. No, he did not.
And did any of the clients come to his office?
I believe only one client came to his office.
40 people?
Correct.
He looked at documents and then talked to them on the phone.
Talked to them on the phone, went out to see.
Do we have the documents in the record?
Those documents are in the record, Your Honor.
In addition to, I assume the documents ask some questions about one's personal wealth.
Financial information, correct.
Exactly. To what degree do the documents detail one's family situation?
They detail it. They detail the information concerning the family situation
but
in terms of husband, wife, children.
Well, wouldn't there be a little more detail that you have a husband, wife, and children that one would need to know?
Well, when you're talking, it really would depend on the situation, Your Honor, in terms of the individual preparing the trust.
Okay, does it inquire into the status of children? Medical problems, physical problems, mental problems of children and spouse.
In the form itself? No, Your Honor.
Wouldn't all of that be essential to doing an appropriate planning of this nature?
It's germane, Your Honor, and it's something that the attorney would review with them when they contact them and when they review the situation.
Is there any evidence that those kinds of discussions took place in his phone call with these people?
There was no evidence presented by the Cincinnati Bar Association that did occur.
Is the future, I noticed that there was a recommendation that the respondent end his relationship with this outfit, and then that wasn't a recommendation. Does he maintain this business?
Your Honor, no. At this point in time, we'd like to have a situation where Mr. Kathman had never met these people from the standpoint of finding himself in the situation that he is here today, and from the standpoint of being an attorney and receiving a notice and saying, you know, you have a problem with this situation. Okay, how do I correct the situation? Well, we've got to draw a bright line in the sand on this case, and you're going to be the bright line object in this case. And
is it your contention that the activities in which Mr. Fox and his group were engaged were not the unauthorized practice of law?
Judge, if there are two cases, one State Bar Association versus Martin, and the other one's Cleveland Bar Association versus Urich. And the Board of Commissioners on Grievances said, we do not find respondents' use of information obtained through respondents' non-attorney employees or agents constitutes a practice of law.
My question is, this the entity before us here, Mr. Fox and this group, were they engaged in the unauthorized practice of law? In your opinion, or, I mean, is it your contention on behalf of your client that they were or were not? They were not, I assume, is what you would contend.
From reading the record, Your Honor, solely from reading the record, I don't think that you can conclude that from reading the record. From a practical standpoint, from advice to an individual.
So your argument then?
That I would provide to someone, I would not have anything to do with, period.
So if they're not engaged in an unauthorized practice of law, then of course your client didn't violate 3101A.
Exactly.
That's your argument, essentially.
Exactly.
So if we find that, if we conclude, as the board did and the panel did, that they were engaged in the unauthorized practice of law, then your arguments about your client's activities and his knowledge and so forth go to the issue of what, that he's acting as a lawyer independently or didn't help them, or what's your argument if we decide that there was the unauthorized practice of law engaged in here? What's your strongest argument on behalf of your client with respect to 3101A?
3101A, Your Honor?
Yeah, that he didn't aid them.
They didn't prove the case. There's no evidence in the record. In terms of testimony from any client or from Mr. Fox or Mr. Kaplan, that Mr. Fox provided. That's the one issue.
Mr. Fox provided what? Mr. Fox?
Provided any legal advice or told these people, if you give me this check, you're going to have a trial.
Now, my hypothetical I want to give to you is, we conclude that Mr. Fox and the others were actually engaged in the unauthorized practice of law. Take that as a given. Now, the question is, did your client aid them in that activity? And what I'm asking for is your strongest argument to us that he did not aid them in their unauthorized practice of law activity.
He acted as an independent contractor, Your Honor. When he talked with them, he told them exactly what the situation was. He was going to review the information, make a determination of suitability, whether it was appropriate or it was not appropriate. If it was not appropriate, they were going to get their money back, regardless of any representations by anybody else.
Do you think they needed, they meaning Fox and his group, that they needed a lawyer to review the documents to make their business scheme, whatever you want to call it, viable?
I think that anybody that wants trust in the state of Ohio has to have a lawyer, Your Honor. I think that that's...
You can't do it from a form book and, like, the probate people take, here's a form book and go and...
Can you do it from a form book?
Well, I mean, you can, but...
If you have a little knowledge, you can do it from a form book. It's just like a divorce, which is a question Justice Douglas asked. What's the difference if we send out a book and they fill out the back of the book? It's just like the get your divorce in an e-packer or whatever they are, they're sold at Walgreens. People don't understand the information, but they'll go to court, file the documents, and depend on the court personnel to kind of help them limp through the
situation. And Mr. Creighton's argument is that here they relied upon Mr. Fox and his people instead of court personnel or their own knowledge, I guess.
Well, they didn't really rely on Mr. Fox, Your Honor, because really when you look at the record in this case, the record clearly demonstrates that once the issue of living trust came up, the ball was shifted to Mr. Kaplan. At that time, Mr. Kaplan made the suitability determination, made all those decisions. Fox's role was more of a financial consultant at that time, and I know how the Supreme Court looks at financial consultants and how financial consultants in the Bar Association, they look at this issue and say, this is our work. It's kind of like being in a union. This is union work, that's management work. But the bottom line is, you have a situation here where an individual did the best he could with the situation that he had in front of him. When he checked the situation out with the Bar Association, he could not even get the correct advice at that time. He was still getting a problem. And as I told him,
so you keep saying, well, they went to the Bar Association and they threw their... What was he thinking when he got involved in this? I mean, what made him think this was all right to do?
What made him think that it was acceptable to do, Your Honor, is that he made a review of the documents and made an independent determination in his mind that it was okay.
You mean that the documents were okay, that the practice, he knows the practice, he understands what's going on. He's getting a quick $200 for blessing this. What made you think that was all right?
When you say for $200 for blessing it, Your Honor, I don't think it's a matter of blessing it. If a matter of blessing it, it's a matter of scribbling your name at the bottom of a document like KFC. This was a situation where he took the time, and if when you review the record, you'll see that he instructed these people that if they had any problems, to call him back. And the question was, did people call him back? Yes, they did call him back. Did he charge him when they called him back? No, he didn't charge him when he was calling them back. He reasonably believed at the time that he entered into this that he was benefiting these people by facilitating this issue.
He was. Does he practice criminal law the same way? Does he go to a client on a telephone and give him advice without ever meeting him?
No, Your Honor. I think eventually he does meet him when they get into court.
Good.
But I think it's there's a big difference there in all deference.
You've used your time, Mr. Kelly. Mr. Gehring, you have about a minute and a half.
Thank you, Mr. Gehring. Your Honor, I think Justice Biker touched on a couple of concerns we have by the Bar Association. First of all, the disciplinary rule is very clear. You shall not aid in unauthorized practice. It didn't take too much for an attorney to look and see, is this the unauthorized practice of what this group was doing? Very clearly, of course.
Counsel, you talk about wanting a bright line drawn. And I'm just concerned that in drawing this bright line, you don't prohibit what may be legitimate practices. There are an awful lot of financial planners and accountants out there who work with attorneys and refer clients constantly to attorneys for legal questions. I feel like the union analysis is my work and your work. How can we draw a line that makes sure we don't prohibit that practice because that's a very valuable thing, a necessary thing? Is the distinction the fact that these documents were already prepared, is that the distinction?
Well, the distinction.
What? People go to their attorney, to their account first, and not to the attorney first. So how do we get over that?
First of all, I think what should come from this decision, in my opinion, is the obligation of the attorney, first of all, to stop the unauthorized practice before it ever starts, and not to get involved in schemes that are set up in this way. First of all, this thing is $2,000 are paid, a legal retainer was signed, and all of the documents were prepared before Mr. Kaplan was involved. So first of all, we have to tell attorneys, recognize this when it comes in, and it's your duty and your obligation not to become involved in those schemes, because the public is what is harmed. The core values here were totally missed of an attorney's obligations. We have competence issues here. Right? I think it's been touched on. Mr. Kaplan wasn't competent to do complicated trusts. He'd never done them before. We have confidentiality issues. We have independence issues that are replete here. One of the things that hasn't been touched on is Mr. Fox, he would take the documents out to get them signed and then at the same time sell them an insurance product while he was being called a paralegal from Mr. Kaplan. So we have all of these issues here, and I think those are fairly clear, and the court can very clearly say to counselors and lawyers, look, certainly it's appropriate to have financial planners, bankers, whatever, insurance people, refer people on, but don't do it after the fact, not after the legal contract has already been signed, to retain you as an attorney, and don't let them advise us to whether it's needed or not. And that's what happened here. We think this the public really would be served by this, and really we are concerned. We don't have any information in this context whether any of these people were harmed. We chose not to go out and find those people and bring them in. But we won't know, these folks won't know if these people were appropriate for them, perhaps until their heirs find out about it and either dead or wrong.
Yeah,
or whether they wasted their money and did anything in the first place.
If we're going to write right line, I guess there are a number of points, as Justice Stratton's question suggests. What if the document was presented to, what if Mr. Zerat responded here was highly skilled and trustworthy, he'd done a lot of, this is his specialty, and the document was brought to him by the same group of persons, but it was not signed. and he was asked to review it. And he spent, you could show he spent 4 hours reviewing the document, all the backup material about the family and the assets and all the sorts of things you'd want to have considered if you were writing a trust. Where's that fall on your on the bright line scale?
First of all, the document should never be prepared by a non-attorney.
Okay, so number one, it should not be prepared. The document should not be prepared by a non-attorney.
Non-attorney. Right. It should be the attorney who drafts the document. Now, obviously, if people come in and say, here's what I would like to do, and certainly we all see this, people might have a modicum of knowledge about what they want to do. Maybe they read a book, for example. But that is different. That's the individual. And we have a third person involved here, or a third entity, if you will, who's actually drafting the documents and saying, here, now you're okay. They should not be drafting the documents. This court has said that's the practice of law.
So if the group does what they did here, except they have a financial, say Mr. Fox, I guess, had a background in financial planning or whatever, and the client comes to the respondent with all this material and says, my financial planner thinks I ought to have these five things, and no document drafted, but the lawyer drafts the document. Is that's okay?
That would seem to be okay to us, because what you have is the financial planner recognizing I don't have the capacity or the ability to advise you about this. Go seek out the independent counsel of your attorney. And then we can talk about whether or not you need insurance trusts or you need other financial products to help fund it. That would be appropriate. And I think that's probably a good way to handle it.
So the lawyer is kind of, the small point in the funnel. It takes all this information and then uses his or her expertise and drafts a document that fits that client. Is that...
Well, also, he should be advising the client. Well, maybe you don't need an insurance trust here. Maybe you don't need insurance for this. Maybe your tax situation is such that you should be doing this. But that all goes to the independent. And that at that point, the attorney is serving the client. And his loyalty goes to that client.
Now, so does the legal advice involved with these, as to whether they're appropriate or not, turn on the sale of insurance? In other words, if the sale isn't consummated, do the documents then somehow become inappropriate?
We don't know that as we see it.
See, insurance...
I'm sorry. Insurance is totally tied in to this. Is that this financial planner then has a reason to continue to try to sell something to the client to help fund this living trust.
But presumably, so without insurance, presumably the person didn't need a trust of any kind.
Perhaps. We don't know that. Once again, we don't know what any particular individual needed or didn't need in this situation with or without insurance. The whole idea of these schemes is avoid probate. And that's really what the sales pitch is. And if you look at the materials, how they go about it.
You can do that with an insurance policy.
A lot of ways to do that.
Without any trust document at all.
There's a lot of ways to do it and avoid probate. And some people may never get to probate anything. And that is enough if they've done certain things during their lifetime in terms of requests or joint survivorship sorts of documents.
So you don't really know what role the insurance follows.
No, we have to
in the legitimacy of the
document itself.
The document and the advice.
We don't know that. We did not get into that. Because we would have to go to each individual person who sold something, and we chose not to do that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gehring. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. The marshal, please adjourn court.